The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Patricia. For the North Carolina Reading Service and for the next hour, I will be reading to you from Time Magazine. Today's program is underwritten by G. Suggs Insurance. Please contact G. Suggs Insurance, your local independent agency, for trusted advice on home, auto, business, and life insurance. For more information, please visit gsuggsinsurance.com. That is GSUGGSinsurance.com. Or call 919-875-8889. Today I'm going to be reading to you from Time Magazine, dated February 13/February 20, 2023. In the upper right-hand corner, it has that little thumb notch that says our 100th year, bordered in red. And as usual, on the front cover, there's no inner border because the background is white, with Time in large block letters, capital letters, in an off-white or pale gray superimposed upon that background. It's a collage of images that fill the rest of the page: people, flowers, flags, and the title is Division and Destiny. Sleepwalking into a less secure future. This is The View, by Kristalina Georgieva, who's managing director of the International Monetary Fund. Early in the pandemic, experts projected the world economy could shrink by almost 10% in 2020. Yet what played out was a contraction of 3.1%, still a huge loss of output, but not nearly as dire. To a large extent, this was due to international cooperation. Countries came together to diagnose the problem, a simultaneous shock to supply and demand. This meant standard policy responses would not be sufficient. That is why policymakers took extraordinary fiscal and monetary measures to support businesses and households. Without this coordinated response, we would have faced another Great Depression. And without the global collaboration of scientists and health authorities, we would not have had effective vaccines in record time. When crisis strikes, as it has so often in the past 3 years, international cooperation can save lives and livelihoods and lay the foundations for a faster recovery. Both the financial response and the vaccines are representative of the broader benefits of decades of economic integration and cooperation, which also helped billions of people become healthier, wealthier, better educated. Over the past 3 decades, around 1.3 billion people were lifted out of extreme poverty. To get there, we had to reach across borders. Think of trade integration, spurred by lower trade barriers and the emergence of global supply chains. And think of the spread of new technologies and cross-border capital flows that have underpinned much-needed investment, especially in emerging and developing economies. But this is only part of the story. The dislocations from trade and technological change have harmed some communities. Inward-looking policies and trade tensions have been on the rise for some years. And now geopolitical fragmentation is raising the specter of a new Cold War that could see the world break into economic blocks at a cost of trillions of dollars in lost productivity. In other words, unless we confront fragmentation, we are at risk of sleepwalking into a future that is poorer and less secure. And as we work to overcome these divisive forces, we must focus on the most vulnerable. This includes many countries in Africa and the Caribbean that are already bearing the brunt of climate change. Should they face this challenge alone, even though others contributed so much more to the climate crisis? Or consider the growing risk of a debt crisis in emerging and developing economies. Should they face this dire fiscal situation alone, even though most are being hit by external shocks rather than domestic policy missteps? The answer must be no. The suffering of one country can easily affect others and threaten global growth. So it is in everyone's interest to urgently strengthen international cooperation on these vital issues. The IMF is founded on the principle that we are stronger together. Thanks to the collective will of our membership, we provided a record $650 billion allocation of special drawing rights, SDRs, funds that allowed many vulnerable countries to maintain access to liquidity, freeing up resources to pay for vaccines and health care. And we're now helping countries with stronger reserves to channel their SDRs to countries whose need is greater. For example, so far we have around $40 billion in pledges to support our new Resilience and Sustainability Trust, which will allow the IMF to provide long-term financing for the first time. Our goal is to help vulnerable low- and middle-income countries build resilience against structural challenges such as climate change and pandemics. While we cannot prevent new shocks, we can bolster the resilience of our people, our communities, and our societies. One thing is clear: we must overcome diminished trust and growing fragmentation, because no country should face these challenges alone. The pandemic showed us we can cooperate to harness human courage, compassion, and ingenuity. And this is exactly how we can help build a better future for all people. Kristalina Georgieva told this story to Belinda Luscombe. Question and answer. David Beasley, B-E-A-S-L-E-Y, the head of the World Food Program, worries about 2023, by Belinda Luscombe. We have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 questions here. This is the question and answer format. Question: a decade ago, Time asked your predecessor whether the planet would always be able to produce enough food for everyone. She said yes. Do you feel that way? Answer: I think we will struggle with having enough food in the future. We may not have enough food for everybody in 2023. There is no doubt we can produce enough food for the world's population. Humanity is strategic enough to achieve that. The question is whether, because of war and conflict and corruption and destabilization, we do. Look, 200 years ago, there were 1.1 billion people on planet Earth. 95% of them lived in extreme poverty. Today, less than 10% are in extreme poverty. But in the last 5 years, we are absolutely going backwards, and it is not just a little bit either. That should frighten the hell out of anybody. Question: why are we going backwards? Answer: when I took this job 6 years ago, there were 80 million people marching to starvation. That number went to 135 million right before COVID because of man-made conflict and climate shocks. COVID comes along, the number goes to 276 million. That's before Ethiopia, that's before Afghanistan, that's before Ukraine. Ukraine grows enough food to feed 400 million people. It went from the biggest breadbasket of the world to the longest bread lines. Compounded by fertilizer pricing, droughts, supply chain disruption, fuel costs, food costs, shipping costs, we now have 349 million people marching to starvation. Question: your term expires in April. What must you get done before you go? Answer: I've worked to awaken the world's leaders to the reality that food security is the crisis of modern times. If you want to know which countries over the next 12 to 18 months could have destabilization and mass migration, start with the 49 knocking on famine's door right now. And the new numbers are coming in on wheat production, grain production, cereal production in India, Argentina, Brazil. And it's down, 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 down. The question now is how to move that forward, because it's not a quick fix. Question: do you ever get annoyed that the U.S. has sent $17.5 billion to Ukraine and not even half that to help the hundreds of millions of people who are starving? Answer: leaders do not have enough money to fund every need. They've got to prioritize what is critical to stability on Earth, things that are in their national security interest. A lot of leaders say, why should I send money to Guatemala or Chad when I've got infrastructure, education, healthcare needs in Michigan or Bavaria? I say a child from Guatemala or Honduras who's in a shelter on the U.S. border costs $4,000 per week. With $1 to $2 a week per child, I can build a resilience program so that child has food security at home. Question: would you like to see a negotiated settlement in Ukraine? Answer: I'm very upset with world leaders. They're all running around playing whack-a-mole and not solving serious problems in the world. Slow down. Solve Yemen. Solve Ethiopia. Solve Ukraine. Just solve one of them. Question: you argue that if we ensure food security, people will stay where they are and it is less destabilizing. Does that hold up in the face of climate change? Answer: if you do analytics on places like Somalia and Sahel, Niger, Mali, Chad, Burkina Faso, where we've been able to do resilience programs, the impact on those communities of recent shocks is less, and they require less support. We can stabilize the population. That also applies to government leaders. I've been trying to get donors to give development dollars to, say, Syria. If I can create food security for the smallholder farmers, they are more self-sufficient and can make independent decisions about their futures. Question: is not climate change still going to send Somalis off their farms? Answer: we cannot blame the Somalis for that, although we can blame them for a lot of other things. I tell leaders, if you honestly believe industrialized nations have contributed to climate change, then you have a moral obligation to provide solutions on the ground for adaptation. Do you believe what you're saying or not? And if you do not, be prepared for mass migration that's going to cost 1,000 times more. Again, that's by Belinda Luscombe. Questions to and answers from David Beasley. Society, the secret tax on women's time, by Lauren C. Howe, Lindsay B. Howe, Ashley V. Willens. Howe, and Willens study the future of work at respectively the University of Zurich, University of Liechtenstein, and Harvard Business School. When studies revealed the so-called pink tax, showing in 2015 that personal hygiene products for her cost 13% more than similar products for men, it caused outrage and action. But there's also an unaddressed pink tax on women's time. A global epidemic of women lacking time to conduct the activities of their everyday lives that men simply do not experience. In fact, men have on average 5 hours more leisure time per week than women, equivalent to 260 hours or 10.8 full 24-hour days each year. Our own research found it is true everywhere. After a conversation with a mother of three from an upper middle class neighborhood of Johannesburg, our colleague Margot Rubin asked, "So you're saying there's nothing outside of money or time that will make anything better?" She paused and said, "Yes." In interviews with working mothers in the crowded and poor Kibera settlement in Nairobi, one lamented, "I have so much to do at home and I still have to go to work. Why is there this time inequality? At home, childcare and chores devour women's time. At work, women, even those who have the security of steady employment, face further unequal time demands. Women are more often asked and expected to take on office housework. Necessary but non-promotable tasks such as taking notes, helping new hires get up to speed, bringing in cake for colleagues, getting coffee for the office. With results that aligned with gender-based stereotypes, one study found women volunteer up to 50% more than men for these tasks. Women also negotiate for time at a lower rate than men. In another study, men were more than twice as likely as women to request an extension when their deadline was adjustable, perpetuating this time poverty trap further. So how can we repeal the pink tax on time? Time-saving incentives are one solution. Giving women money or vouchers to pay someone else to complete daily tasks that erode their free time. Cooking, shopping, laundry, bringing children to school, household maintenance, or to shorten the time spent on tasks like providing money to take a taxi instead of a bus, services such as backup child care or prepared takeaway meals can also reduce time burdens. Given that buying time is a luxury few can afford, policy innovations are also needed and could be particularly impactful if expanded and adapted to reach those with the lowest incomes around the globe. For example, in field research in Kibera, Kenya, women in informal settlements reported meal and laundry services would be most helpful in saving time. The research team then worked with a local community center to offer these time-saving services, finding they reduced women's perceived burden of unpaid labor by 7% and resulted in a 5% increase in well-being during the study. Another hurdle is to get women to actually use these time-saving services. Overturning social norms is key, both for women and for men. For example, 60% of women find workplace flexibility key to future jobs, but many believe that a risk to flexible work is that any time women gain will be consumed by domestic responsibilities. At the same time, men get criticized at work when taking on child care responsibilities, even resulting in workplace penalties like demotion. Lastly, free time needs to be reframed as essential rather than as unproductive and wasteful. Spending time on activities such as exercising, volunteering, or socializing predicts happiness, and valuing leisure over work is related to greater fulfillment. Mindsets must shift to view leisure as necessary rather than nice to have. From the brief innovation, When Science Meets Seafood by Amy Gunia, Singapore. Sandhya Sriram is impatient. The stem cell scientist wanted to put her knowledge to use developing cultivated seafood, but no one was doing that in Singapore. So 4 years ago, she set up a company to create lab-grown crustacean meat. Eagerly, she registered her company, Shiok Meats, that's S-H-I-O-K, at 3 a.m. in August 2018. Nobody was doing crustaceans, says Sriram, Shiok's group CEO and co-founder. What do Asians eat the most? Seafood. It was a simple answer, and they are so delicious. A lifelong vegetarian, she'd never tried real shrimp, but she sampled it the week she registered the company. Today, the results of her enthusiasm can be seen at Shiok Meats headquarters in an industrial Singapore neighborhood. During a fall 2022 visit, a bespectacled bioprocess engineer clad in personal protective gear peered into a microscope. He had taken samples from a bioreactor in the room next door where the company is culturing crustacean cells. Under the lens, he was checking to see if the cells were ready to harvest. Shiok Meats has already unveiled shrimp, lobster, and crab prototypes to a select group of tasters, and it plans to seek regulatory approval to sell its lab-grown shrimp by April 2023, right about now. That could make it the first in the world to bring cultivated shrimp to diners, putting it at the forefront of the cultivated meat race. As of this writing, only one company has gained regulatory approval to sell lab-grown animal protein products. Eat Just's cultured chicken is available, but only in Singapore. Shiok Meats still needs to submit all the paperwork necessary and get regulatory approval, but the company hopes to see its products in restaurants by mid-2024, offering foodies a cruelty-free and more environmentally friendly option than crustaceans from farms. But even if that ambitious timeline is met, it will likely be a while before the average person is eating cultivated crustaceans. It will require not just regulatory approval, but more funding in a bigger factory, along with persuading consumers and governments around the world to accept lab-grown seafood. We are at an interesting stage of a startup. It's called the Valley of Death, says Sriram. We're in a space where we have not submitted for regulatory approval yet, but we're looking to commercialize in the next 2 years. Nevertheless, the impatient entrepreneur is optimistic. Sriram, and that's spelled S-R-I-R-A-M, hopes to have the company's next manufacturing plant ready by the end of 2023, where a 500-liter and a 2,000-liter bioreactor will be a major scale up from its current 50 and 200-liter bioreactors. The goal is for her products to enter the mainstream in Singapore in 5 to 7 years. Popularizing these products could help tackle some of the environmental impacts of crustacean production. Organic waste, chemicals, and antibiotics from seafood farms can pollute groundwater and coastal estuaries. Hatcheries are often in places that may otherwise be home to mangroves that can sequester carbon and protect vulnerable coastlines from storms, says Sriram. A 2018 Nature study found that production of crustaceans measured by the weight of edible protein can result in carbon emissions comparable to beef and lamb. That's in part because of how fuel is used in fishing boats, proportional to the end product amount of protein obtained. And although shrimp and lobster accounted for only 6% of seafood, based on 2011 data, the study found they represented 22% of the industry's carbon emissions. Shiok Meat says the way it produces crustacean meat minimizes animal cruelty, as growing protein in a lab helps avoid killing animals. Trawling vessels that ensnare bycatch are also avoided, and cultivating shrimp closer to where it is consumed cuts emissions from fishing boat fuel and shipping products around the world. Asia consumes more seafood than any other region. Several food tech companies are tapping into this demand, including a Hong Kong company making lab-grown fish maw, a Chinese delicacy, and a South Korean company also developing cultivated crustaceans. but Shiok may have a first-mover advantage. In 2018, it filed for a patent covering how to use stem cells from crustaceans to make food, which it is hoping to receive in the next year or so. It could then license its technology to other companies. Diversifying how and where the world gets its seafood will be crucial for feeding Asia's fast-growing population, which is expected to increase by 250 million by 2030. Singapore's authorities, at least, are keenly aware of the challenge. The Southeast Asian city-state, which lacks farmland and imports 90% of its food, is aiming to produce enough food to meet 30% of its nutritional needs by 2030, up from less than 10% in 2021. Hoping to become Asia's food tech capital, Singapore is focusing on innovations like plant and cell-based proteins. These require far less space and resources to produce the same amount of food as traditional food sources. Bernice Tay, Director of Food Manufacturing at Enterprise Singapore, a government agency that supports small businesses, told Nikkei Asia. In December 2020, Singapore became the first country to approve the sale of cultivated meat, the chicken product from Eat Just, to the public. Sriram says the government has helped Shiok with grants in matching venture capital funding and in hiring foreign talent. The company's raised about $30 million with backers like Netherlands-based aquaculture investment fund AquaSpark, South Korean food giant CJ Shale Jadong, and Vietnamese seafood company Vinh Hoan. Fundraising is challenging, says Sriram, and it's expensive to scale up manufacturing, which is being hampered by a global shortage of stainless steel needed for the bioreactors. Ultimately, the company's goal of feeding the world will be contingent on other governments getting on board with lab-grown meat. Then there's the need to persuade consumers to eat the stuff. Price is also a barrier. Shiok Shrimp's launch price will be about $50 for 2 pounds, nearly 2 to 4 times the price for fresh or frozen prawns at the grocery store. Sriram envisions launching Shiok's crustacean meat as a premium product at first, where some restaurants could offer it in select dishes to diners willing to pay the price. She also plans to work with food manufacturers like CJ Shale Jadong to create ready-to-eat products like dumplings. The vision, she says, is to have sustainable, delicious, healthy food for everybody without animal cruelty. And among other photos, there is a photo here of cultivated shrimp dumplings by Shiok Meats. I'm not an expert on shrimp dumplings, but they do look tasty. They're being served in a bamboo basket. Next is an essay, Death by American Brutality. The beating of Tyree Nichols is hard to watch, but we must bear witness, by Janelle Ross. We find ourselves as a nation in a nauseating position. In the hours before Memphis police released video of the beating death of Tyree Nichols, a 29-year-old black man, cable news anchors, filling some of their copious time, spoke of the police footage as hours away from release, soon to come, and with other terms typically reserved for sporting events, major political speeches, and moments of scandal. The city, newscasters said, was on edge. Memphis's black female police chief, Sarah Lynn Davis, and surrounding Shelby County's district attorney, Steve Mulroy, a white man and Democrat, have been lauded for their comparatively swift, decisive action. Before footage of the beating was released, the 5 black officers involved in Nichols' January 7 beating were fired and indicted on multiple charges, including official misconduct and oppression. second-degree murder, aggravated assault, aggravated kidnapping. In the hours and days after its release, two more police officers and two sheriff's deputies were suspended, at least one of whom is white, and three EMTs, two black and one white, were also fired. Davis described the contents of the tapes as revolting, reflecting a disregard for human life. So here we are, days after the airing of what is effectively a police snuff film, an execution on tape for what may have been no crime at all. That stomach-churning fact is, of course, possible because of America's stop-start, sometimes hard to call sincere, commitment to do something about the number of people killed by police each year, a disproportionate share of whom are black. At the same time, there have been a range of warnings, suggestions, publicly declared refusals to watch the footage. Rovon Wells, instead these people, including Nichols' mother, Rovon Wells, have said Nichols should be remembered the way he lived. He was, his mother said, tall and lanky, in at 150. He was a beautiful soul, artistic, his own person, not perfect, but damn near close, Wells said at a January 27 press conference before the videos were made public. He was a man who liked to take his chances on a skateboard and photograph Memphis's architecture, scenery, and sunsets. But when she saw him last, comatose in a hospital bed before his death January 10, his neck and nose had been broken, the latter resembling an S. Nichols. Head was swollen, Wells said, like a watermelon. The nose was resembling an S. And then Nichols' head was swollen, Wells said, like a watermelon. His on-tape beating, some who refused to watch it said, was just more black death porn on the pyre, an unnecessary psychic wound for people who already know all about the damage done by American policing. Years ago, a newsroom colleague, a white woman who also liked to joke that on her frequent getaways she could tan to a color browner than me, asked me if she was obligated to watch yet another police execution tape. That time it was 17-year-old Laquan McDonald's 2014 shooting death by Chicago police. It had taken more than a year since his killing to get the tape released, unlike the 20 days since Nichols' beating in Memphis. I gave her the answer I knew she wanted and perhaps needed to hear. Only you know your own limits, what you can and cannot handle, so do whatever that demands. Just find a way to connect with the facts of what happened, to be well and accurately informed. And I'd probably say the same today to those who are hesitant, but I would add this. Those of us who are adults, living and breathing, must contend with the fact that unchecked and unlawful policing, a state-funded force with nearly unlimited power and little to no accountability, not only allows for assaults on citizens, but threatens democracy. It is an element of a fascist state. Add to that, those of us who are black know that next time it could be me who was killed. I've watched Laura King, daughter of Rodney King, peer through a steady font of tears at a looped video of his 1991 beating. She did not look away. She looked straight ahead at what America was, and, it appears, is. She only briefly closed her eyes. And at least some of us adults have to join her to bear witness to the current contours of American brutality and consider what, if anything, can be done. Those who do not are within their rights. It may be necessary for mental health in deeply troubling times, already pockmarked by mass shootings and death. But there's also the disquieting fact that images of official violence on the Edmund Pettus Bridge in 1965 and on a Minneapolis street in 2020 have played a role in boosting public support for policy changes and forced some people who, because of their own race, have very different experience with police, to admit that some officers have done something illegal and inhumane. The law of qualified immunity, some of white America's indifference, and the highest court in the land together shield many officers from accountability. Police departments across the country have shot and killed about 1,000 people per year since 2015, according to a Washington Post database. Those figures do not include beating, choking, and other deaths caused by police uses of force. Some of these deaths, a policing expert told me just before Derek Chauvin's trial for the murder of George Floyd, are not even recorded as deaths caused by police, because it comes down to what medical examiners are willing to list after an autopsy. And overall, data on deaths caused by police, or even the relationship between officer race and officer conduct, are so inconsistently collected by departments that patterns are difficult to verify. But three things are clear, Max Markham, Vice President of Policy and Community Engagement at the Center for Policing Equity, told me before the tapes were released. Black drivers in multiple cities are significantly more likely than white drivers to be subjected to a traffic stop. Traffic stops are the genesis of a large share of incidents that lead to a use of force. When black Americans do come in contact with police, they're also significantly more likely than white Americans to have some type of force used upon them. And there's one other thing. It is too reductive to say that because most of the first responders involved in the Memphis incident were, like Nichols, black, the beating and other choices made that led up to it had no relationship to race. The policies and practices that prompt officers in many cities to disproportionately pull over black drivers produce racially disparate, some might say racist, results, Markham says. And Memphis is an interesting place to examine policing policy, practice, and culture, or at least its history. In 1971, a group of white Memphis police officers caused the death of a 17-year-old black boy named Elton Hayes following a high-speed car chase. Police initially claimed the boy's injuries were caused by a crash, but the medical and other physical evidence told a different story, showing the boy had been severely beaten in a ditch. 2 years passed before prosecutors took the officers involved to trial. When they were all acquitted of charges, including murder and assault, what police called riots followed. Hayes's was one of two deaths of a black young person under similar circumstances that year. 3 years later, a black police officer shot and killed a 15-year-old black boy named Edward Garner as the teen was climbing a backyard fence after allegedly burglarizing a house where no one was home. The boy's father, Clem T. Garner, was what a lawyer who worked on the case described as a regular working man and a decorated World War II veteran. He was appalled that his son's life could be summarily ended and filed a suit that went all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court. During his testimony in a lower court, the black officer who shot Garner was unusually candid, describing a sickening police culture where he was congratulated for the killing. Some, perhaps even many, officers carried drop guns to plant on suspects and put notches on their service weapons for every black person they killed. When the Supreme Court decided Tennessee v. Garner in the family's favor in 1985, the ruling established that police could not shoot fleeing suspects unless the officer believed the suspect posed an immediate danger. For many states, this was the first guideline for use of potentially fatal force set since the 19th century. And for a time, it reduced the number of people shot and killed by police across the country. Then officers got better at using the ruling's precise language to render a shooting justifiable. The standard has since changed. It now varies from state to state, but generally speaking, force can be used when officers say they perceive a threat to their own or other lives. Today, despite the seeming wall-to-wall coverage of events in Memphis and the relatively quick firing and arrest of the officers, the vast majority of deaths caused by police will not lead to criminal charges, and an even smaller subset still, infinitesimal may be more accurate, will lead to an officer's conviction. So we who are alive to see it, or at least take in the essential facts of what happened to Nichols, do have a range of choices, including the degree of solemnity those of us who watch bring to the viewing, and what those of us who do not say about a man's last moments in immense terror and pain. The precise sequence of events is difficult to parse. In the footage from the officers' body cams made public, little can somehow be seen. Much can be heard. But an overheard outdoor camera mounted to a pole provided a view of the beating. An officer approaches Nichols' car after a traffic stop. The officer's yelling curse words and commands then physically jerks Nichols from the vehicle. Nichols is repeating the words, "All right, okay, then why?" as officers yell more commands and land blows, pepper spray, and tase his body. Nichols flees. Officers lose sight of Nichols, chase him, curse, and pant as they catch, kick, beat, and again pepper spray Nichols while he's pinned to the ground. There are blows from what looks like a police baton, along with additional punches and kicks to the head. There are demands that Nichols give the officers his expletive hands and lay flat expletive, although at points he appears limp and is not moving at all, and at others is moving slowly under an officer's body weight. Among the last things Nichols cries out on tape as he's held by several officers on the ground, about 100 yards from his mother's home, is the word, "Mom." Nichols can be heard moaning, and eventually officers trying to get him up are told to grab his foot. Some begin to discuss their belief that he's on something, a claim frequently made by officers in legal cases where excessive force has allegedly been used. That assertion by officers at the scene has not been proved by postmortem tests and exams that have thus far been made public. Nichols is not heard speaking again. Officers prop what looks like an unconscious Nichols against a police car. He repeatedly slides toward the ground. The officers at points chatter among themselves about what they've experienced. And despite the presence of paramedics, for several minutes no one appears to check on Nichols' condition at all. From Time Off, here's a review. The 12-year-old boy who fell to earth. And this premiered February 3 on Apple TV Plus. In the Apple TV Plus drama Dear Edward, a jet falls out of the sky, killing everyone on board except 12-year-old Edward Adler. That he's lucky to be alive is cold comfort. His parents and beloved brother are dead. He's sent to live with a bitter aunt, Taylor Schilling, and post-traumatic stress abounds. "Sometimes," says Edward, luminous newcomer Colin O'Brien, "I feel like the crash is still sitting on that field and it's never going to stop burning." It is an apt metaphor for the series' central theme, grief. Unlike plane crash thrillers from Lost to Yellow Jackets, Dear Edward is no puzzle box, adapted by Jason Kottims, Friday Night Lights, Parenthood, from the novel by Anne Napolitano. It's a warm-hearted but uneven ensemble drama grounded in a support group for the victims' families. One prominent member is Dee Dee, Light's star, Connie Britton, a rich empty nester untangling her late husband's web of secrets. Broke, pregnant, and alone, Linda, Amy Forsyth, reaches out to the parents of a fiancé, who perished. In another incongruous storyline, idealistic Adriana, Anna Uzela, vies to replace her congresswoman grandma, a crash casualty, while falling for a Ghanaian entrepreneur, Idris Debrand, from the grief group. Tertiary characters expand the collage of love, lies, and impulsive behavior. Known for putting viewers in their feelings, Katims was a natural choice to helm Dear Edward. But his weepy sensibility, distributed throughout too many plots and hammered home by plaintive indie folk, yields an overly earnest melodrama. Few characters get enough screen time to evolve beyond stock types. The exception is precocious, angry, erratic Edward. If only Katims had not insisted on depicting grief writ large, he might have created a moving portrait of one very specific experience with it, by Judy Berman. Essay, again by Judy Berman. The network comedy is not yet, that's not dead yet, and this is Time Off Television. The latest comedy to join ABC's prime time lineup tells what is, in many ways, a familiar story. Like The Mary Tyler Moore Show and both incarnations of One Day at a Time before it, Not Dead Yet follows a woman starting over after a big breakup. Journalist Nell Serrano, played by Jane the Virgin star Gina Rodriguez, introduces herself by way of a headline: Local Woman, 37, Ruins Own Life. Fresh off a 5-year stint in London that ended in a broken engagement, she is back home in California with a fussy roommate and a job writing obituaries for the local newspaper. She left to chase romance. The twist: she meets the ghosts of her obit subjects. With its mix of time-honored TV tropes and quirky, attention-grabbing flourishes, Not Dead Yet epitomizes an emerging generation of network comedies. As recently as the fall of 2021, it looked as if Big Five broadcasters had given up on the format, which thrives on the perhaps outdated assumption that if the jokes are good enough, viewers of all demographics and political persuasions will come together to laugh at them. But a rapidly shifting TV landscape, and one that now allows most networks to efficiently monetize their programming on their own streaming platforms, seems to be encouraging networks to develop series that appeal to younger, more adventurous, and progressive streaming audiences, as well as, if not more than, the aging, linear viewers who reliably flock to procedural franchises and game show reboots. Among hour-long dramas, this transition has made space for subtle updates to the ever-popular crime genre, like Fox's new episodic courtroom anthology, Accused. The evolution of the network comedy has been a more delicate balancing act. To gain traction in prime time, these shows need likable characters, jokes with punchlines clear enough to cue up a laugh track, and a comfortingly familiar format. At the same time, it can take an unconventional premise to attract the attention of a streaming audience that is inundated with content and accustomed to dark, high-concept half-hours like Netflix's Dead to Me and FX on Hulu's Reservation Dogs. Younger viewers, to their credit, also expect to see characters that represent a wide range of identities. Hence the hybrid that is Not Dead Yet. Based on English author Alexandra Potter's novel Confessions of a 40-something K up, the series relocates its actions across the Atlantic, throws in some ghosts to zhush up the premise, and recasts a conspicuously younger Nell as a Latina writer in a post-racial, LGBTQ-inclusive office. Her roommate, who turns out to be on the autistic spectrum, is played by Rick Glassman, an autistic actor last seen in Amazon's groundbreaking neurodiverse dramedy, As We See It. The show has a weakness for inspirational platitudes. We're all a work in progress, and its depiction of a newsroom might be even less authentic than its depiction of the afterlife. But Rodriguez makes an irresistible lead. Backed by sharp performances from Glassman, Hannah Simone as Nell's work wife, and Lauren Ash as the paper's Nepo Baby editor. It is not a fantastic show, but it's punchy enough to hold your attention. It is not alone either in coming off as a compromise between two very different sets of sensibilities. NBC's American Auto, now in its second season, casts Anna Gasteyer as the clueless CEO of a car company who reigns over a diverse, long-suffering staff of millennials. Like creator Justin Spitzer's previous NBC sitcom, Superstore, the show flirts with critiquing capitalism, but its reluctance to risk the truly subversive big business satire, most recently perfected by Comedy Central's Corporate, hobbles both its commentary and its humor. Eliza Coop, Maggie Q, and Jennifer Goodwin led the cast of last year's Pivoting, an irreverent Fox comedy about three women reevaluating their lives in the wake of a childhood friend's death. An initially promising series that never quite struck a balance between conventional sitcom beats and a more morbid strain of humor, it was canceled after a single 10-episode season. So far, this new school of broadcast comedy has yielded just one great show, Abbott Elementary. With the exception of CBS's hit-or-miss Ghosts, a Britcom remake about a young couple who move into an old house overrun with apparitions that kind of bring to mind the occult elements of Not Dead Yet, Quinta Brunson's ABC sitcom about an underfunded Philadelphia public school is also the only title that can fairly be called a breakout hit. Like Not Dead Yet, it balances progressive values with old school, hugging and learning sentimentality. But midway through its second season, and already renewed for a third, Abbott stands apart because its specific mix of political engagement and humanistic warmth feels organic, grounded as it is in Brunson's own upbringing and her mother's experiences as a teacher. An exceptional comedy on any platform does what even the most thoughtfully cast intergenerational compromise hashed out in a boardroom could not. It rings true. And Time Off recommends a few things here. A book, Old Babes in the Wood, Margaret Atwood's first book of short stories since 2014's Stone Mattress, features 15 tales that find humor and humanity in eccentric characters, from a mom who claims to be a witch to a snail who's been reincarnated as a bank employee. Music, this is why. Following a 5-year hiatus, beloved pop punk group Paramore will release its 6th studio album. The lead single, which shares its name with the album, captures the feeling many experienced at the height of pandemic lockdown of struggling to muster the will to leave the house. Another book, Wolf Fish. That's one word. In her nonfiction debut, Erica Berry explores wolf self and the stories we tell about fear with a singular blend of history, science, cultural criticism, and memoir. Along the way, she tracks one famed wolf, OR7, on a journey through northeastern Oregon after straying from his pack. Music, Raven. After a long hiatus, R&B artist Kalayla follows up the 2017 release of her futuristic celestial debut, Take Me Apart, with a dance-centric sophomore album led by several promising club-ready singles. Television, Fight the Power. With the subtitle, How Hip-Hop Changed the World, this thoughtful and thorough PBS docuseries from executive producer Chuck D traces the rise of a revolutionary art form with a particular focus on hip-hop's political impact. And on television, Extraordinary. Hulu's new superhero comedy, which follows a hapless 25-year-old Mairead Tyers, T-Y-E-R-S, the only one of her friends who did not receive a superpower at 18, will appeal to fans of millennial underachiever farces like Broad City and Search Party. We have run out of time for today's episode of Time Magazine. I hope you enjoyed it. Be sure to listen next time. I am Patricia, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Today's program is underwritten by G. Suggs Insurance. Please contact G. Suggs Insurance, your local independent agency, for trusted advice on home, auto, business, and life insurance. For more information, please visit gsuggsinsurance.com or call 919-875-8889. Time Magazine is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have comments or questions, call us at 919-832-5138. That is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.